It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining us today, Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College, joining us by phone. Hello, Wayne. Great to have you back on the program.
Hi, Ben.
Jim McCormick is with us of Iowa State University, where he's Professor of Political Science. Welcome to you.
Welcome. Thank you very much.
Kelly Shaw, also of Iowa State University. We haven't had him on our Politics Wednesday before. Kelly, welcome to you, a political science lecturer at Iowa State University.
Thanks very much, Ben. Good to be with you.
I've said it nearly every week in the last few months, and it's true every week. So much to talk about in politics, both domestically and abroad. So let's get right to it. Later in the hour, we want to talk about the continued fallout from the Brexit vote, the Benghazi final report. Of course, through all this, we'll weave in the 2016 presidential election, as now we are less than 100 days away from that November vote. Let's first, though, gentlemen, talk about the attack yesterday, late yesterday, the gun and bomb attack at an airport in Istanbul. 41 dead, more than 230 injured. Signs pointing to a so-called Islamic State responsibility in the attack. Wayne Moyer, what do you see here? And tell us, why would Turkey be targeted?
Well, Turkey's targeted because Turkey is allowing a use of one of its air bases, maybe more than one of its air bases, by American forces who are bombing ISIS. So that would be pretty good motivation if, in fact, and I think it's increasingly likely that ISIS is behind the attack. My main concern with this, though, is that this attack is going to increase the authoritarian tendencies of the Turkish government and moving away from democracy, and that could well contribute in the long term to instability in Turkey.
Mm-hmm. It works in favor of ISIS, then, if they do react that way.
Yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm. Jim McCormick.
Yeah, I mean, my reaction was, you know, just simply the brutality of it and the senselessness of these actions. I really am constantly puzzled by how, you know, these individuals can engage in these kind of suicide attacks. It's really hard to understand. But I also think from the American perspective, of course, it kind of perpetuates the frustration that we have in terms of how to deal with these kind of actions. I mean, what could or should we be doing to address this kind of threat? I mean, we can increase, I noticed in some of the reports this morning, increased airport security and so on. But it does really raise this whole question about what exactly can be done. I mean, I think Wayne's point about what's going to happen within Turkey, and Erdogan has already moved in this kind of a authoritarian direction. Will this give him even more impetus? But I also think that it's going to raise within the U.S., should we what else should we be doing?
Mm-hmm. Turkey announced their plan to normalize diplomatic ties with Israel just a few days ago. Jim, do you think that has something to do with this?
You know, I really don't think it has as much to do with it as what Wayne talked about in terms of the actions of, you know, Americans using the Turkish air base in southeast Turkey to bomb ISIS, and the fact that, you know, Turkey has been involved with taking on ISIS here, as well as Syria, as well as the Kurds. So there's been a lot of different targets. I don't think it directly, certainly this is probably could have been anticipated. I mean, Turkey for the longest time until just a few years ago did have kind of normalized relations with Israel until this incident at sea. So I think that this is less the case than, and particularly given that what I read into this incident was that it was pretty well planned what they how mm-hmm. they were going to proceed for this. So I don't think it was this kind of the spur of the moment action.
Kelly Shaw, thoughts to add to what Wayne and Jim have said here?
Well, you know, certainly, Ben, I would second what both Wayne and Jim have said. One thing I would add, though, is Turkey, you know, is very kind of a good microcosm of a country caught in transition. You know, Wayne has mentioned the fact that the government has become a little less democratic, and that's kind of a euphemism, a little less democratic the last couple of years. A lot of us don't realize in the West that, you know, Turkey, which was once an Islamic state, had moved largely to a secular world. And in a number of ways, that really put them in the crosshairs for a number of Islamic terrorist organizations, such as Al-Qaeda. one of the things that Osama bin Laden really wanted to do with al-Qaeda was to target those secular states that had formerly been Islamic. And as a Europeanist and kind of a specialist on the European Union, you know, I feel some sympathy for Turkey, not only because of the bombings that took place, you know, last night and the horrific elements associated with all that, to Jim's point, but also the fact that, you know, Turkey has tried to play by Western rules, and they are, you know, there's some question if they're European or if they're Middle Eastern or even Asian. I mean, such a large country. And so they've tried to play by the rules of the international organizations, the international games. You know, they've kind of been led on for a long time by the European Union to receive membership, to the point where Prime Minister Cameron from the UK said, you know, that's not going to happen in my lifetime. And I think, you know, Turkey is this country that has tried to liberalize its politics, but it really is caught between the two worlds, the first world where we have the plural democracies, and, you know, the developing world, and particularly the Islamic world, in which we don't see some of those liberal tendencies existing. So I guess sympathy certainly to the Turks. I have a number of friends who are Turkish and have been impacted by this. But we also have to realize that Turkey is in this fight, if you want to call it, with us against this radical Islam movement that we tend to see.
Right. Following on your comments there, Kelly, what does this do with the narrative that some people in this country have we are at war with Islam? And here we have ISIS attacking an Islamic state, albeit a secular state of Muslim people.
Right. Yeah. You know, those are the stakes, right, that we live in, and certainly the stakes that Turkey has been trying to address, and really a tightrope. And it's understandable, given domestic politics in Turkey, that, as Wayne mentioned, the government has become a little more authoritarian towards their people, and certainly less liberal in terms of voting rights and whatnot. But it does put them in certainly a difficult spot. And it really is kind of a microcosm in my assessment, Ben, of I know we're going to talk about Brexit in just a few moments.
Yep.
But really kind of is a microcosm of that. As you know, Turkey sits between Syria and Iran and Iraq and a number of hot spots. You know, and when I was in the UK last week, they oftentimes use Turkey and some of those border states as a example of what we don't want in the UK. And certainly that's the rhetoric we've heard from Donald Trump in terms of, you know, not allowing Muslims in this country, you know, building walls and whatnot. And sorry to make this transition to the Brexit discussion, but it is quite relevant to the migrants and immigrants question, and it's something certainly that Europe is having to face. You know, Turkey is at the crossroads of that migration route, if you will. And again, as they say, you know, it only takes a couple of bad apples to upset that apple cart. And again, unfortunately, you know, we don't know exactly who was responsible yesterday in Turkey. We do know about France and Brussels, that those were indigenous groups that had close ties to Syria, but we're, you know, citizens of those respective nation states. And so, you know, it's becoming very difficult in this war on terror, quote unquote, to identify who our enemies are. And, you know, we do see kind of this populist rhetoric, not only from some of the right parties in the UK, but certainly from Donald Trump, that, you know, it's just easier to close our borders than to deal with these issues. And that resonates, for better or for worse, and in my estimation, worse, that resonates quite well with a voting public.
Kelly Shaw of Iowa State University with us, along with Jim McCormick of ISU and Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College. Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're heavily tilted toward the international arena with the recent occurrences, the bombing yesterday in Turkey, and we do want to dovetail nicely right into the continued fallout of the Brexit vote, Britain's referendum, the shock decision for the United Kingdom to leave the EU. We haven't talked since that's happened. Wayne Moyer, how significant is this as you've been watching it over the last few days? How will Brexit change the EU, the world?
I think the biggest problem with the whole Brexit situation is both political uncertainty and economic uncertainty. The economic uncertainty that comes out of this is likely to lower investment, slow international growth, reduce job creation, and that could be really problematic for England as well as for the EU. And politically, the whole European project, the whole idea of ever greater integration between the European Union members is in jeopardy. And I worry that this whole process of integration may be reversed and slowed down, or even Europe may begin to unwind. And geopolitically, I see that as very problematic, in the sense that a united Europe is very important now with an increasingly assertive Russia.
Jim McCormick, do you share Wayne's concerns there,
unwinding
of the EU?
He really summarized it very nicely about the political and economic uncertainty here. I mean, the United States position has been, at least from, I was thinking about this since John Kennedy talked about a United States of Europe and how much he wanted that Europe to be this kind of second fulcrum, and that was during the Cold War, but it's really continued that we have wanted this free, and George H.W. Bush talked about a free and united Europe here as well, bringing in a whole series of states into the economic European Economic Union, as well as within NATO here after the end of the Cold War. So this has been a longstanding kind of policy of the United States. And so it does, in terms of, as Wayne talked about, with a rising Russia and at least a more assertive Russia under Putin here, it really raises questions about how much the Europeans will be able to hold together here. Mm-hmm. I think the other kind of impact that I see is that, you know, they talked about moving towards greater political union or economic union, and I think that probably that process is going to be, you know, put on hold in the short term.
Mm-hmm. Kelly, I want to ask you, because I know you've been looking into this, how the various parts of the UK voted differently. We have England, also Northern Ireland, Scotland, Wales. there has been talk that we could have, say, Scotland or Northern Ireland break away from the UK to rejoin the EU?
Right, Ben. You know, that's been something that's risen in the Scottish press in the last week or so. Certainly, you know, Scotland had their vote, a referendum back in September 2014 on independence. And it was closer than probably the government, i.e. the Prime Minister, wanted it to be. But ultimately, Scotland decided to stay in. You know, the periphery in Britain is different from the center in the sense that it is usually less wealthy. It needs more development, needs more money that comes in for infrastructure and whatnot. And the British periphery has really benefited from what used to be called structural funds from the EU. They're called something else. But those poorer regions tend to get a better deal, if you will, from the European Union, because, frankly, their economies and their infrastructures really need a insurgence of cash. And so it's not surprising that when we look at the vote, particularly in terms of Scotland and Northern Ireland, it's not terribly surprising that the persons who voted in favor of staying within the European Union, because the benefit there is greater. Also on the periphery, Ben, you know, those countries tend not to have the immigration issues that we see in London and in other parts of England, particularly the southeast of the country. And as a result, you know, they don't see some of the crime associated with, you know, the unemployed and whatnot, and frankly, some of the terrorism that we see in major hubs such as London. And so it wasn't terribly surprising to me when I was there last week. I laughed at the election was going on Thursday. It wasn't terribly surprising to me to see Scotland certainly vote in favor and Northern Ireland voted in favor. And interestingly, the more nationalist part of Wales, the northern part of Wales, actually voted in favor of remaining within the EU. So it's kind of a perpetuation of this rift that exists in the periphery, between the center and the periphery. And so we have seen from the SNP and the First Minister of the Scottish Parliament talking, or perhaps rattling her saber, if you will, a little bit about having another referendum. And, you know, there's some question, even Wayne, some question, Ben, whether or not Scotland, as part of the UK, could remain within the EU if they remain part of the UK? Probably not. There's some question about that. Gibraltar, for instance, is a kind of a similar nation state which voted in the UK election to stay within it as well. So, you know, the whole question about the regions is interesting, but it's very clear that there was, as oftentimes in British politics, a very clear division between the center and periphery that took place. I would also add, just real quickly, that there's quite a difference between older voters and younger voters.
Yes.
With the latter group really in favor of the EU. And I think some of the freedoms, the four freedoms, as we talked about in the EU, that they bring along, you know, young people are in a better position to take advantage of that, particularly the economic freedoms that come along with the European free trade area and whatnot. So there are some differences, certainly, over the vote. You know, the majority last Thursday voted in favor of leaving, but there are clear cleavages between the regions and also between generations in the EU, and in the UK, I'm sorry.
Kelly Shaw, Jim McCormick, Wayne Moyer, our political analysts on this Politics Wednesday. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Tom is with us in Sioux City. Hi, Tom, coming up on a break, but we'd love to hear what's on your mind.
Well, I just wanted to point out to the three advisors that I wish you should have found an economist from Iowa State to talk to. I do insurance and investments here in Sioux City, and this is a big deal, don't get me wrong, but it's not the tsunami or the crisis thing that would happen if Britain had actually given up on the pound and gone with the euro in 2000. The fact that they've still got their sovereign currency and they've still got all their sovereign debt denominated in pounds is going to make this divorce, you know, messy and whatever, but it's not going to be like the War of the Roses or anything.
Okay.
The analogy I've been using with clients is that when they decided to renounce, when they did not join with the euro in 2000, it was like they were going to get married, but they wanted to be the bachelor that kept his bachelor pad in case you wanted to get a divorce easily down the road. And
right.
So it's you can't minimize it, but man, if they had all their sovereign debt and everybody's mortgage was denominated in euros, I mean, that'd be a world class bloodbath.
Okay,
and where France and Germany decided to go.
Tom in Sioux City, thank you for your perspective from the financial sector, at least here in Iowa, one part of it. As a matter of fact, this week, Governor Branstad said there may be an upside for Iowa exports after the historic vote for the United Kingdom to leave the European Union. He spoke at his weekly news conference and said the change may create opportunities for Iowa companies.
And the European Union has, you know, has been a challenge to us, especially when it comes to agriculture products. So we need to look at, are there opportunities now that we have with the changes that's going on there to open them up?
Okay. Branstad also saying that GMO restrictions in Europe have been bad for Iowa exports. He predicts low interest rates as the market upset continues. And just to pile on here, that perhaps are we looking at this too negatively? Louise says, she writes us on Twitter, the e-media are screwing this up. Have you seen anything positive on the BBC or Sky? No, all leavers are uneducated, poor, stupid. It's all that negative. We will come back from this. Reaction to that, is there an upside? Is just a matter of how you look at it, Wayne Moyer.
Well, one thing that strikes me, and I'll come back to what Governor Branstad is saying, as a result of the whole Brexit crisis, the dollar is stronger. And as the dollar is stronger, that's not good for agricultural exports. So I see that a negative side that the governor missed.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that the EU is going to get rid of its, kind of the wall that's built around us that the governor was referencing here. It's not going to be that much easier for Iowa products or American products generally to get into the EU because of this. I mean, I suppose there might be a little increased trade with Britain because even there, with the decline of the pound, it's going to make it hard, as Wayne said, for them to buy very many more American products.
Mm-hmm. We're coming up on a break in a couple minutes, but I want to get this part out. Yesterday, we heard Germany's chancellor. Germany, of course, the European economic powerhouse in the EU. Angela Merkel telling Britain it's not going to be able to cherry-pick parts of the European Union that it wants, such as the single market without accepting principles like the freedom of movement when it negotiates its exit from the bloc. So, Kelly Shaw, as we wind up this conversation on Brexit, is this the EU making an example out of the UK in order to prevent other members from leaving the family, possibly?
Right. You know, I think that is correct, Ed. And certainly Merkel has oftentimes looked to for direction because of the important role that Germany has played in the integration process and project that is the European Union. And so I think that is a pretty serious shot across the bow from Merkel in terms of letting Britain know that, hey, look, this a la carte approach that you've taken to the EU since you joined in 73 is no longer going to be the case, particularly if you don't have the leverage of membership anymore. And so, you know, I think that she'll probably soften, as she oftentimes does, and other ministers require her to do so. But I think that is certainly the first, you know, shot across the bow, if you will, regarding that. Let me touch just real quickly. I know you're against a break, but I worked for the European Union for 6 years, and one of the issues certainly that I worked a lot on was genetically modified organisms. And to my good friend at Iowa State, Jim McCormick's point, the EU is not going to suddenly allow GMOs into the EU. You know, they have a long tradition, long history there, tied economically, tied to ag and whatnot. So while I like Governor Branstad's optimism, he is correct. Jim is correct in the sense that really the only opportunities for Iowa markets now to increase would really be within Great Britain, because the GMOs that drive our agribusiness sector here in Iowa and the Midwest are still not going to be welcome in the remaining 27 member states.
Well, Wayne and Jim are going to be with us in the second half hour. We're going to say goodbye to you, Kelly, in a moment, but you have a few seconds. Tell us, how strong are the movements I've heard in other countries in the EU, France, Sweden, the Netherlands, this movement to detach from the EU? Do you expect it to be a dominoes?
You know, I don't expect it really to be a domino, Ben. When all the dust settles from this, you know, membership in the EU is still better than being out, in my estimation. You know, the gentleman from Sioux City, when he called about, you know, it's not the end-all, be-all, certainly not the case for Britain, and it's not going to be the end of the EU either. You know, the EU has 27 other members that are going to continue this European free trade area. The real cost, if you will, to
just
Britain,
a few seconds.
Fact,
yeah, finish up, please.
Yeah, cost to Britain is that they're no longer in that free trade area once they leave.
Okay, very good. Thank you so much. We hope you'll be back soon. Kelly Shaw, political science lecturer at Iowa State University. Thanks for your input this half hour.
My pleasure. Thanks, Ben.
Wayne Moyer, Jim McCormick, please hang on. We're going to continue a little bit about Brexit, perhaps after the break. But then, of course, we want to talk about this final Benghazi report that killed report on the event that killed four Americans in 2012. And how that may affect this campaign. Also, we'll look at the 2016 campaign and poll numbers, recently poll numbers. Donald Trump's campaign not looking rosy. When we look at the poll numbers, we'll ask our analysts why when we come back. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. Wayne Moyer and Jim McCormick back in just a few minutes. And we're back midstream on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In 1961, President Kennedy said the U.S. needed to put a man on the moon. Now, more than 50 years later, Vice President Joe Biden says the nation needs a cancer moonshot. Tomorrow on this program, a discussion I had with a panelists at the Iowa Cancer Moonshot Summit, including remarks from Joe Biden, as well as researchers from the University of Iowa Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center. The Iowa Cancer Moonshot Summit tomorrow, Thursday, on River to River over the noon hour. Today, Politics Wednesday, and so much to talk about in the international arena. So glad to have with us, lending us their expertise, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. Wanted to finish up with our talk on the fallout from the Brexit vote, the UK leaving the European Union. A lot of questions surrounding just how and when that will happen, but the referendum took place, and it was a shocker. And people are trying to decide what will happen now. Let's have you talk a little bit, since last half hour we talked about more of the European politics side of it. Let's have you react to what President Obama said when speaking with NPR's Steve Inskeep on Monday of this week about how immigration concerns affected the Brexit vote and how it will affect the presidential vote in November in President Obama's view.
I think that some of the concerns around immigration, some of the concerns around a loss of control or a loss of national identity. Those are similar. I think there's a xenophobia and anti-immigrant sentiment that's flashing up, not just in Great Britain, but throughout Europe, that has some parallels with what Mr. Trump has been trying to stir up here. So overall, I think that the differences are greater than the similarities. But what is absolutely true is that the ability to tap into a fear that people may have about losing control and to offer some sort of vague nostalgic feelings about how we'll make Britain great again, or we'll make America great again, and the subtext for that is somehow that a bunch of foreigners and funny-looking people are coming in here and changing the basic character of the nation. I think that some of that is out there, both in Europe and in the United States. And again, that's not unique to England. You've seen it in the Le Pen party in France. You see it in some of the far-right parties in other parts of Europe as well.
President Obama speaking with Steve Inskeep of NPR on Monday. Wayne Moyer, so do you agree with that analysis by the president about the forces at work both on this and the far side of the Atlantic?
Essentially, that I do. I think an underlying problem is there are segments of both the European populations and the American populations who feel left behind. They've not done well in a world of globalization. And so when you feel left behind, you look for a target. And immigrants are always a natural target, the sense that they're coming in and they're taking the jobs away from your people. And trade is free trade is another natural target. Somehow or other, it's trade agreements that we've made that have kept us from doing well. And then politicians can take that and build it up and play up people's fears. And that's what I think we saw in Brexit. And to some extent, we see it in the presidential campaign in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Jim McCormick, Donald Trump has really hitched his cart to this pony named Brexit. I guess if Brexit turns out in the next few months to be really disastrous for the European Union, that would not be good for Trump.
Well, I'm not sure at all. I think by raising these kind of issues, though, I mean, that's what he's really trying to tap into within the American electorate. I mean, I think that this whole business of Britain leaving the EU is going to be spread out considerably. You know, there's really, and we didn't get into it, but there's really a discussion even of maybe we'll have a second look at this. You know, they're going through a prime ministerial change. Because Prime Minister Cameron said he won't stay on, and it'll be interesting to see what happens in terms of Britain itself. But I think that Trump is going to continue to play on this issue of immigration, and I think the wider issue that Wayne identified of globalization and what globalization has meant for people, or particularly within Britain. I think that's going to be a continuous theme with candidate Trump as well.
Mm-hmm. It's our Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Jim McCormick of Iowa State University and Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College. Want to get to a couple of other things before our hour ends. It's quickly ending as we have so much to digest and hear about. Let's talk about yesterday's report, the Congressional Republicans in a long-awaited report, accused the U.S. State Department of failing to protect four Americans killed in the 2012 attack in Libya, in Benghazi. The final report contained no new major revelations. But Republicans say that Hillary Clinton, who was Secretary of State at the time, and her staff showed a, quote, shameful lack of response to congressional investigators looking into the attacks on the U.S. Compound in Benghazi, Libya. Let's listen to Republican representative and chair of the House Select Committee on Benghazi, Trey Gowdy, speaking yesterday to reporters. Hear his answer in the question of whether the report contained any new information and whether it was the best use of taxpayer dollars and of your time.
You didn't know that a single U.S. military asset did not meet a single designated timeline. Think about that for a second. The world's most powerful military did not meet a single solitary self-imposed timeline. So all of that is new. As for the Democrats, color me shocked that they are critical of our report. All five of them voted not to form the committee. They threatened not to participate, and for the most part, they did not. They have been serial leakers of information, and they missed a really good opportunity. I don't know if you've had a chance to read the report or not, but if you read the report, you will see their report mentions her name far more times than our report does. Our report doesn't mention the presumptive Republican nominee for president because he's got nothing to do with Benghazi. So you can direct those questions to Elijah and the rest of them. I'm actually proud of what we found, and I think it's new.
Okay, in reaction, speaking yesterday at a press conference, White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest said the Benghazi committee's goal was to tear down Clinton's poll numbers.
It seems at this point that there, after eight different congressional inquiries have now been conducted into this matter, it seems that there's only one remaining question. And it's simply this. Is the RNC going to disclose the in-kind contribution that they received from House Republicans today? This was a $7 million effort funded by taxpayers to do what the would-be Speaker of their House says was their goal, which is to tear down Secretary Clinton's poll numbers. The fact is, those congressional committees that have been committed to trying to understand the facts of a tragedy that led to the death of four Americans have concluded that what happened was a tragedy. But they've also concluded that the variety of conspiracy theories that have been flowering on the Republican side of the aisle are politically motivated fantasies.
Okay, there you have it, two opposing readings of the Benghazi affair. And the deaths in that event. How do you read this latest final report, Jim McCormick?
Well, I think it does confirm some things that we already knew about the episode here in terms of the and provides a timeline. I've looked at a little bit at the, I haven't read the whole thing, but I read some of it. I mean, one thing that was interesting and which I think the Republicans will use as a sort of part of their fodder against Hillary Clinton is the fact that one of these meetings that was held on the evening of these events going on, that they spent a lot of time talking about, this video as the explanation rather than moving to taking any action. I think that's going to be one of the interesting kind of points that come out for Republicans. I think the other thing that came out in the report was that Ben Rhodes, assistant national security advisor to the president, was also involved in when Susan Rice went on the television programs, on the Sunday programs, that he had sort of talked to her about, prepping her, if you will. And again, that became the video picture. So I think that's going to be part of the kind of narrative that the Republicans are going to use. On the Democratic side, it seems to me that, as Secretary Clinton said yesterday, there's really nothing that we really learned that was particularly new about the episode. Yes, it was a tragedy, but we really need to move on and provide greater kind of security. I think that we have not heard the last of this. I think it'll be in campaign commercials. I don't know how much traction it gets in terms because of the details involved in this whole episode, but it does, I think, in terms of the kind of portrayal of whether this is a trustworthy person in terms of managing the foreign policy. I think that'll be the kind of linchpin point that will be used from the report.
I can just add a little to what Jim said. It seems to me that one of the things that comes out of the report is that the main problem was not Hillary Clinton and the State Department, but the Defense Department that wasn't really prepared in advance to take on a rescue mission like this and was unable to respond under the circumstances as well. And I think Jim was alluding to this. There were clearly problems in the White House with Susan Rice particularly.
Mm-hmm. And yet Donald Trump has spoken about this. He spoke last week, for instance. Let's listen to this from his New York City hotel calling out Hillary Clinton for her handling of the attack on the U.S. consulate in Libya in 2012. Let's hear his charge.
Ambassador Stevens and his staff in Libya made hundreds and hundreds of requests for security. They were desperate. They needed help. Hillary Clinton's State Department refused them all. She started the war that put them in Libya, denied him the security he asked for, then left him there to die.
Wayne Moyer, any truth to what Donald Trump just said there?
I think that misconstrues the reality and focuses this situation much more on Hillary Clinton than she deserves.
Jim McCormick, you agree?
Yes, I agree. I mean, the whole question of security, you know, probably goes up the chain of command, and I think it was pretty clear that she wasn't really aware of some of these kind of requests for increased security. It probably falls to these kind of middle-level bureaucrats in terms of providing greater security. But it does sound from the report, frankly, that the security was pretty abysmal within Benghazi.
Okay, we're finishing up this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Jim McCormick of Iowa State University and Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College. Join us if you have a question or a quick comment about what we've been talking about today, 1-866-780-9100. Let's talk a little bit about the 2016 presidential campaign exclusively. We've had it woven into many of our themes so far this hour. Some of the latest poll numbers, Donald Trump said last week he hadn't really started campaigning in the general election. And I guess you could say it really shows in these poll numbers. Hillary Clinton polling higher than Donald Trump in seven swing states, holding leads in these seven states from 4 to 17 percentage points. This is a new poll by Ballotpedia released today. Clinton's lead was smallest right here in Iowa among the registered voters who responded, leading by just 4 points. But these other leads, for instance, in Michigan, a traditionally Democratic-leaning state where Trump has said he could compete in November, Clinton in this poll leading Trump by 17 points. Other polls, I'm sure you've seen them, the National Poll, ABC News, Washington Post, and NBC News, Wall Street Journal, released last week, I believe. But when you put them together, to differ to some degree, but both are consistent, the broader trend that Clinton holding a reliable lead over Trump, sometimes swelling to double digits. Jim McCormick, what do you see in these poll numbers?
Well, I see real trouble for Trump in terms of making any kind of a recovery. I mean, his campaign, you know, strategy and his whole campaign organization, you know, has certainly not come into fruition here. I guess what he can best hope for is that the convention helps him get a little bit of a bump and that his vice presidential candidate really will spark some support, particularly among Republicans here, because even among Republicans, he's not getting anywhere near the kind of support that he has in terms of facing the general electorate.
All right. That Republican convention coming right before the Democratic convention. So I guess this gives the Democrats a little bit of an advantage, wouldn't you say? They get to come a week after and know who the VP pick is, wouldn't you say, Wayne?
Yeah, no, I think that's certainly the case.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. She's participated this week in her first rally with Hillary Clinton. This is in Cincinnati on Monday, and we've edited the applause a little bit for time's sake.
Now, I'm here today because I'm with her. Yes, her. We're all here today because we're with her, and we're going to work our hearts out to make Hillary Clinton the next president of the United States. Are you ready for this? Yeah. We're here with someone who gets up every single day and fights for us. Someone who has spent her whole life fighting for children, spent her life fighting for women, spent her life fighting for families, fighting for health care, fighting for human rights, fighting for a level playing field, fighting for those who need her most.
Okay, Elizabeth Warren speaking on Monday, her first rally with Hillary Clinton. Jim McCormick, a lot of speculation, of course, that Warren is one of the top Clinton VP picks on the short list for sure. Do you think Warren is a good fit?
Well, it is a good fit in terms of trying to get some of the Sanders supporter, because she obviously comes from that wing of the party. And certainly the clip that you just played there, she sounded like she would be a very good, do a very good job in terms of attacking Trump, and she's already done that in other venues. I'm not quite sure, though, that that is where I think some of the Sanders people are going to naturally swing towards Clinton, and Sanders has vowed that he's going to make certain that the Democratic platform veers more to the left here in terms of what he wants. So I think that she probably needs somebody that is more attractive to independents here.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't be surprised if Elizabeth Warren was chosen. But I think kind of strategically, somebody who might attract independents would be a better choice.
Any names on the tip of your tongue there, Jim?
Well, I mean, the most popular one is Tim Kaine, the senator from Virginia here. And I mean, I think that he probably, at least to my mind, goes in as kind of the favorite among the possible VP choices.
Mm-hmm. What is your read on Elizabeth Warren as a VP pick, Wayne?
I very much agree with what Jim is saying. And another factor that I think Elizabeth Warren is also 63 or 64 years old, and Hillary Clinton is, I think, will be close to 70 at the time of the election. And do you want both president and vice presidential candidates to be of essentially the same age group?
Mm, okay. Let's talk a little bit of something as we conclude. Mentioned in the top of the hour news this week, the NRA's political arm launching its first ad campaign in the 2016 presidential race, a $2 million Benghazi-themed campaign for Trump. It's coming, of course, a couple weeks after the mass shooting in Orlando, after which House Democrats supported the Senate's gun control filibuster. What are your predictions on how much gun control, gun legislation, gun rights will be a major narrative in the debates leading up to November? Jim?
I think it'll be one of the issues. I don't think it'll be central. I think the economy will still be the central issue. But what the gun debate does, and the whole Benghazi does, of course, is to try to call into question, at least from the Republican point of view, Secretary Clinton's credibility in the foreign policy realm. And I think that's the way, you know, these things sort of fit together here, that terrorism, you know, gun control and the economy will be kind of in the mix here. But I would still see that, you know, given we saw numbers yesterday in terms of the GNP or GDP growth rate as about 1% in the latest quarter, I think that's still going to be the dominant theme.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just add one other point. To the extent that you can link terrorism to getting access to guns freely, I think that increases the possibility that it will become a major issue in the campaign.
Okay, so it depends on if we have further terrorist attacks, tragedies here, and how they are interpreted through partisan lenses, I guess.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so very quickly, before we have to go, what are each of you looking out for in the coming days as we look at the presidential campaign? Jim?
I'm looking forward to hearing who Trump picks for his vice presidential candidate. I think that may be really crucial to any kind of prospect that he has of sort of resurrecting his campaign.
Mm-hmm.
I think it'll be the most important kind of choice that he's made to date.
Will we hear that before the Republican convention?
I think so. I think that they want to go in because, you know, the whole issue of whether the convention is going to be at all unified, there's all these kind of rumors now. I think that he has to have some way to bring a sense of unity to Republican identifiers.
Okay, Wayne Moyer, just 15 seconds.
I agree with Ben, but the other thing is, can Trump stay on his message, or will he go freewheeling and shooting from the hip again?
Okay, Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College, Jim McCormick, Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Wayne and Jim, such a pleasure to have you and your expertise in the room, so to speak, this hour. Thank you so much, Wayne and Jim.
Thank you very
Ben.
Much.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon, with help from Lauren Knutson. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Remember, tomorrow at this time, Iowa's Cancer Moonshot. I'll be leading a panel discussion with 10 panelists tomorrow. Also, we'll hear remarks from Vice President Joe Biden. That's tomorrow on this program. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.